Translation. When Shakuntala responded to Maharaj Dushmanta's proposal with silence, the agreement was complete. Then the king, who knew the laws of marriage, immediately married her by chanting the Vedic pranav Omkara in accordance with the marriage ceremony as performed among the Gandharvas. Purport. The Omkara pranav is the Supreme Personality of Godhead represented by letters. Bhagavad Gita says that the letters A-U-M combined together is Om, represent the Supreme Lord. Religious principles are meant to invoke the blessings and mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna, who says in Bhagavad Gita that he is personally present in sexual desires that are not contrary to religious principles. The word Vidina means according to religious principles. The association of men and women according to religious principles is allowed in the Vedic culture. In our Krishna consciousness movement, we allow marriage on the basis of religious principles, but the sexual combination of men and women as friends is irreligious and is not allowed. So, translation again. When Shakuntala responded to Maharaj Dushmanta's proposal with silence, the agreement was complete. Then the king, who knew the laws of marriage, immediately married her by chanting the Vedic pranav Omkara in accordance with the marriage ceremony as performed among the Gandharvas. Omaganta Mirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshuram Mulitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Shimati Bhakta Vedan Swamni Tanamane Namaste Saravati Devi Gauravani Pracharne Nevise Shashunyavadi Pastacha Dishitarne Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhanitananda Shri Advaita Gadatar Shivasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna. So continuing this story in this chapter, the dynasty of Puru. There's a very nice verse that is said by Sanatana Goswami about the Srimad Bhagavatam. And see if I can remember the Sanskrit first. So it's Srimad Bhagavatam Puranam Amalam Yadvaishnavanam Priyam Yasmin Paramahamsya Ekam Amalam Gyanam Param Giyate Tatra Gyana Viraga Bhakti Sahitam Nishkarmyam Vishkritam Tachchrinvan Supatan Vacharano Paro Bhakti Vimuchan Naraha. So it says the Srimad Bhagavatam is a spotless Purana. It is very dear to the Vaishnavas because it describes the pure and supreme knowledge of the Paramahamsas. This Bhagavatam has the means to deliver us from all the activities of work, together with all the principles of transcendental knowledge, renunciation, and devotion. So one who sincerely tries to understand the Srimad Bhagavatam and properly hears and chants it with devotion, they will achieve complete liberation. So to completely achieve complete liberation. So this is actually the ninth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam has this kind of over title of liberation. So we know that the Bhagavatam, it stretches from the lotus feet of the Lord to above his head. So the first two cantos are described as being the lotus feet of Krishna. The tenth canto is the smiling face of Lord Krishna, and this ninth canto is about the dynasties of the sun and the moon, about the ancestors. So the ninth is about that, it's about ancestors, because the human form of life is the opportunity by which we can approach Lord Krishna, we can remember our relationship with him here in the material world. So this is an aspect of the ninth, about our ancestors, about these great souls who came in the dynasties of the sun and the moon. Of course, Krishna came in the dynasty of the moon, and then we have soon Lord Ramachandra Bhagavan coming from the dynasty of the sun. So you have all these great Rajarishis, the great Kshatriya kings coming through these dynasties into the world. And so that we can all, because we can learn from them, from from this Bhagavatam is about our opportunity. It's given to us so that we can learn how our ancestors approached devotion, how they approached the Supreme Lord. Because ultimately, we come under the protection of the divine nature of the Lord. And who is that Lord? Well, Lord Brahma, he speaks in his Brahma Samhita prayers so many wonderful things that we should know about that Supreme Lord. There's one, Ekopya Sau Rachaitam Jagadandakotim Yachchaktirasti Jagadanda Chayananta Andantarasta Paramano Chayantarastam Govinda Madhipurusham Tamahambhajami. So he is an undifferentiated entity because there's no difference between the potency and the possessor thereof. So in his work of creation of millions of worlds, his potency remains inseparable. All the universes exist in him, and he is present in his fullness in each of every one of the atoms scattered throughout the universe at one at the same time, such as the primeval Lord whom I adore. So Lord Brahma is telling us that the Supreme Lord Krishna, he's existing in huge form, he's encompassing everything, but yet he's in the tiniest atom as well. And we know that he sits within our heart also. So this is, we're under the protection of that divine nature. So this liberation is the boon of the human form of life, to remember that position that we're in. So we have been hearing about all these like great Raja Rishis and also some of the other Kshatriya kings who were maybe a little bit more prone to lustful desire, not quite so mighty as some of them. But like King Yayati, obviously dealing with lustful desires. And now we meet King Dushmanta, so another great Kshatriya king. And I was thinking that one of the things about these Kshatriya kings was because they had that facility of great opulence and power, it means that they had the time and the position to really investigate the nature of desire and what it means. So they would take many queens, so many, and they would satisfy all these desires. These were the great Kshatriyas. So they had time to explore that. So I remember like one time, and I had a friend in north of Scotland when I used to live and work up there, and he had a metal detector, and he used to go around some of the ancient castles. You know, Scotland is famous for these ruins of old castles from the old days. And one particular castle, he discovered that he started digging up all these hoards of silver and gold coins. And he said it was really interesting. But don't try this at home because it's very illegal. You're not supposed to do it. But he was doing it. And he found just like scattered around in a big area within a mile of the castle, all these little hoards of coins. So he wondered, why are they just all in one place and not scattered all over the place? And then he came up with a theory, because in the old days, the noble families would come and meet up and they would have meetings and banquets and all the rest of it. And by the lustful nature of us humans, they would get together with members of the opposite sex and go off for rendezvous in the bushes and trees. And while they were having these rendezvous, then the coins would drop out of his pocket. That was his theory. A good theory. I can't think of any better one. But if you take that, to extend that to India, then you can imagine in India, with the climate and the opulence, all the amazing plants and spices that they had, such amazing opulence that we probably can't even conceive that these kings had in their possession. So that was this kind of like very romantic life that they probably led. So here's another example of a Kshatriya king, King Dushmanta. So we're hearing that he's been out hunting with his associates, and he's very tired. And then suddenly in the forest this beautiful woman is there, like dressed very simply. But immediately King Dushmanta is attracted towards her, and she is attracted towards him. So, and this, they introduce each other. King Dushmanta, he gives this very like romantic line. He says, "Well, you know, you must be the daughter of a Kshatriya." He says, like in modern times, you might say, "You must be a Virgo, you must be a Libra, or something like that." But he's saying, "No, you must be the daughter of a Kshatriya." And I myself am from the Puru dynasty, so my mind never endeavors to enjoy anything irreligiously. So he's introducing himself as a great Kshatriya with great great principles. And she mentions that she is born of Kshatriya as well. So, and her name is Shakuntala. So Shakuntala is very interesting because we might have met her before, being the daughter of the great sage Vishvamitra and Minika, the Apsara girl from the heavenly planets. So that story itself is very incredible. And it's become over time, it's gained many kind of erotic overtones just by the fact that there's a great sage meditating and this like heavenly girl comes down and breaks his austerity, and then they have union together. But we're not, as Vaishnavas, we're not interested in the erotic overtones. We're interested in the principles and the Leela. So the story was that Vishvamitra was a great sage. He was performing great austerities, and so much so that it said all the lower atmosphere of the earth was burning up with heat. That was the effect of it. And so King Indra, he becomes a bit worried when the great sages get that level of power, because he wants to retain this power in the heavenly planets. So what does he do? He sends down one of his Apsara girlfriends from the heavenly planets. Very beautiful, of course. She comes onto the earth, and Vishvamitra is literally just like an anthill at that time, because you're talking about thousands of years of meditation and austerity. So he's just literally an anthill. But this anthill is burning like white hot with the heat that is generated from his meditation. So she spends some time circumambulating him, and eventually the anthill, all the covering falls away, and with the tinkling of her ankle bells, gradually he awakens, and then they have union together. And from that union comes Shakuntala, this girl. And the trouble is for Shakuntala that, for one thing, Vishvamitra, he's actually very angry, as you might imagine, because after thousands of years of this austerity and meditation, he's had it broken by this girl, so he's very angry. So Minika, the mother, she realizes, well, he can't be any kind of father to Shakuntala. And Minika doesn't want to be the mother because she wants to go back to the heavenly planets to be with Indra. So she gives this child to the forest. So that's where that story leaves off. But what happens is that in that forest, some birds come, Shakunta birds come to protect the baby. And because, of course, the jungle is a very dangerous place, lions and tigers and all the rest of it. So one day this Kavya Muni comes along, and there's this baby being protected by these birds, by these Shakunta birds. So he calls her Shakuntala because of the Shakunta birds protecting her. So anyway, that's the story of Shakuntala. So now she has been maidservant of Kavya Muni at his hermitage. And now King Dushmanta has come along and they've met together. And so now we hear about the actual marriage, because they have a marriage. And it's described this Gandharva marriage. Which is interesting, because Gandharva marriage is a marriage where the couple just choose each other. They choose to associate and marry with each other. Unlike the other forms of marriage, the usual one would be the parents would decide who the parents would be, but this is different. There are other types of marriage as well. For example, Rakshasa marriage. The example of that is when Krishna comes to get Rukmini. So Rukmini's already kind of betrothed to someone else, but Krishna just sweeps in his chariot, lifts her up onto his chariot and runs away with her. So this is Rakshasa marriage, but really only Krishna can really do this, because he's the greatest of all heroes. So it's not very common, the Rakshasa marriage. Another one is just eloping together, just running away together. And there's a famous place in Scotland. In the old times, couples who wanted to get married but they weren't allowed to, they run away to a place just across the border into England called Gretna Green. and they would get married there. So that's another example of marriage. And then there are other types of marriage. You have the combinations of Brahmins, Kshatriyas, and all of the rest of it. But this is Gandharva marriage. So they're choosing each other. And so then it mentions that for this marriage to come, first, Maharaj Dushmanta gives a proposal for marriage, and she responds with silence. So I'm assuming we don't really know much more about that. Just, well, obviously she wasn't objecting, so she didn't say anything. So that was one aspect. But then the other aspect is that Maharaj Dushmanta, he chants the pranava, the om. And why does he do this? Because he's a kshatriya, because we mentioned he's interested in religious principles. So by chanting om, he's inviting the Supreme Lord to be present. So of course Krishna, the Supreme Lord, is present in om. So therefore the marriage becomes bona fide, because the Lord has now been invited into this meeting by the chanting of om. So this is the aspect of the principle of religion. So the principle of making the commitment for life. Because Srila Prabhupada is quick to say, and I think it's the previous purport, so the Gandharva marriage is marriage by agreement, but it doesn't mean that divorce is a principle of disagreement. So now in the modern age we're having so many divorces, so the marriage takes place and then there's disagreement. So you agree to disagree and then you divorce. But this is not at all accepted in the Vedic tradition. This is not actually a religious principle. It's more about making a commitment for life, and this is what it should be. And that's why when the Supreme Lord has been invited into this, then it should be a commitment for life. So even in the modern religions like Christianity, there is an aspect of the Lord being present for the ceremony, so it should be for life. But due to the nature of Kali Yuga, often it's very whimsical, or people will not find in themselves the strength to maintain a marriage, and they'll just jump from one to another, one marriage after another. And because that's not following religious principle, what do we see when we don't follow religious principles? We just see chaos. It results in chaos, because then we're existing outside that shelter given by the Supreme Lord, who is everything without and within. So when we choose to step outside that sacred circle, you could say, then everything becomes chaotic and unprincipled. So that's actually our position in the greater sense, because that example analogy is given of the child who goes to his mother and says, I want to be a doctor, and the parent says, well, okay, if you want to be a doctor, then you should start going to school now, studying really hard, because then later you can go to university for 9 years and then you can start to practice and eventually you'll become a doctor. And the child says, well, that's okay, dear parent, but I want it now. I want to be a doctor now. So what the parent does is goes into the shop and buys like a toy plastic stethoscope, a toy doctor bag, all the rest of it, and uniform. So the child thinks, plays like he's being a doctor, and he goes around with a stethoscope trying to hear the heartbeat of the cat and the dog and all the neighbours and everything else, until the point where he realises, actually, this is, nothing's really happening here. So, but if it's really within the dharma of that child, then the child will start to think, actually, I do have to start taking this seriously. Maybe I should start to learn what really it means to become a doctor. So this analogy, it means that because we wanted to enjoy being Krishna for ourselves, to enjoy all this sense gratification, even though we're not entitled to it, then Krishna, out of his mercy and compassion as the ultimate parent, gave us the material world to play around in. And we can play around in it until the point when we realize, actually, this is not really beneficial for us, so we better actually try and understand what our real position is. So this is really kind of a lot about religious principles, because Arjuna had said on the battlefield, he had said, if I fight in this battle and kill all these men, then the women will be unprotected and there'll be unwanted population as Varna, Sankara. But Krishna very quickly steps in and reminds him, actually, that's not the case. If you, as a Kshatriya, step down and refuse to fight in this battle, then you are the reason for unwanted population in the world. You'll be the reason for the unwanted population, the Varna Sankara. So Arjuna had his own idea that he was thinking, well, logically, if I kill all these people, then the women will be unprotected, then it will result in unwanted population. But Krishna has taken the ultimate principle that one has to live by one's dharma. So Arjuna is a great kshatriya. He has to fight in the battle as a warrior. If he doesn't, then that will result in unwanted population because the example of whatever action a great man performs, then lesser men follow. And what a great example is set in the world, then the world will pursue that example. So Arjuna was told he should be that kshatriya as a great example for the world. And that principle exists in the world. Because of course Arjuna, he could have gone to the forest and just lived by begging, and he might have done okay out of it. But others wouldn't, because otherwise others might have tried to copy him, and they might have tried to go to the forest. Well, if Arjuna can do it, I'll do it. I'll go to the forest and just renounce everything. But others were not qualified to go to the forest and renounce that they can't do it. So therefore, it wouldn't work. So it's the responsibility of the great souls to show that example. So society needs to follow these regulative principles, the religious principles, under the guidance of the Supreme Lord or the Supreme Lord's representative, the spiritual master. And in doing so, the population of the world can become peaceful and very organized so that they can actually progress in spiritual life. So these principles of religion, they're not like just dogmas or man-made ideas. Actually, they're standing on the four primary regulative observances. So you have austerity, cleanliness, mercy, and truthfulness. So when Maharaj Parikshit was walking around the planet, he came across this horrible sight of Kali beating the bull. So the cow and the bull were there. And the bull only now had one leg left, which was truthfulness. So the other legs of religion, which were austerity, cleanliness, and mercy, were already disappearing. So this was where we're introduced to these four great observances: austerity, cleanliness, mercy, and truthfulness. But Maharaj Parikshit, he let Kali live. He was going to kill him, but then he remembered that he should let him live. So Kali is leading all those who are in ignorance, he's leading them on in this age of Kali. It's his age. But what are these regulative observances really? It's very important. Sri Sri Radha Gokulananda Bhagavan Ki Jai, Sri Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman Ki Jai, Sri Prabhupada Ki Jai. So austerity is very important. It's because there are certain things that we can do for our spiritual realization, for spiritual progress, but we might not want to do them because it gives us discomfort to the body. We prefer to enjoying our senses, gratifying the senses. But actually, there are certain things that we can do which are good for us. That means we have to give that up for some time. So that's what austerity is. And even though that leg of the bull was gone already, it doesn't mean it doesn't exist in the world, because it does still exist in the world, austerity. And we should actually be practicing that. For instance, today is Ekadashi day. And traditionally, in the Vedic age, everybody would fast completely from food and water, except for the old and the sick. They didn't have to, of course, and certain individuals like Bhima and others who wouldn't do it. But generally, the people would take that day, so 2 days a month, 4 days before the new moon and 4 days before the full moon, the people would all fast completely. So this was an austerity which they performed. And you find also that, you hear about that through the Christian religion as well. I don't know about Islam, if it's there. And so actually it's scientifically proved that, because actually when we take foodstuff within our body, it takes 4 days for the nutrients from that foodstuff to really replenish the brain to keep it going. We don't notice that because we're eating all the time, but actually it does. So that means that if you fast on the Ekadashi day, then when it comes to the new moon day or the full moon day, your body is very peaceful, because actually the energy in a full moon day, as you might have noticed, and a new moon day, it's very extreme. Like when I was married, my wife, she used to just, in a full moon day, she would close all the curtains in the house. She would go crazy on full moon, and I had to look after her every time. It's bizarre. But it has a strong effect on people. So if we follow Ekadashi, then our mind is very peaceful when it comes to that day. It's very interesting, because it's all a science. This is all like the principles given by the Supreme Lord for us to follow. So it's worth to endeavor, even though it's not very pleasing to us, and there's a bit of suffering, it's well worth the effort to do austerity. Then there's cleanliness. So we need to clean the body and the mind, of course, because the accumulated dust in our mind, actually the only way we can clean that dust from our mind is by glorifying the Supreme Lord. There is no other way. There is no other way. That's the way to do it. So that's why in a godless civilization, we can't actually become purified in that way. So there you go. You can look at history to see that one in action. So that's austerity and cleanliness. Then you have mercy. So that's just about compassion and forgiveness and giving options to other people, not trying to be the complete controller, not being the tyrant, but actually having that, finding that mercy within our heart for others, for our brothers and our sisters, and compassion, very important. And then truthfulness, which is the leg of the bull, which still remains in Kali Yuga, although it's diminishing all the time. That's there. So in Satya Yuga, the pure age, there was 100% peace of mind. Everybody was very peaceful completely in their mind, but then that degraded with the ongoing ages. So in Treta Yuga, that peace of mind was already down to 3/4 of what it was in the pure age, and then in Dwapara Yuga it was down to a half, and Kali Yuga it's down to 1/4. So we're really suffering quite a bit. We're just coping, so we don't have much peace of mind. So these regulated principles, they're designed even for in Kali Yuga to give us some potential for advancement. So we seeing in the world just how to really work against these principles in Kali Yuga. So of course, you know, to work against the principle of austerity, we can get into intoxication. So through intoxication, we can really lower our consciousness and destroy like our likelihood of following any spiritual path. So intoxication kind of has to be given up, because it's also poisoning the brain and poisoning the body. It's not very good. We can see the result of intoxication in all the lovely people we meet when we're talking with them and meeting them. It's very rife, of course, in Kali Yuga, and it's accepted as a way of being, I want to have it my way, and that's the way I'm going to have it. So that's what comes from intoxication. So that mood is prevalent in the world. But that's directly working against the principle of austerity. Then there's gambling, which works against the principle of truthfulness. So in our age, there's a lot of gambling. So truthfulness and honesty goes out the window. People become involved in gambling. And of course, it's ruining lives left, right, and center. People just taking gambling money, gambling. They're putting their whole possessions, putting them down on the table with the hope of winning something more. People's lives become completely ruined. Against the principle of mercy and compassion is, of course, animal slaughter. And this animal slaughter, of course, that's taking away mercy and compassion as well. But it's also promoting great selfishness and cruelty in the world, because these animals are our brothers and sisters, of course. They're not different than that. So we should be accepting them. Of course, Krishna is telling us very directly that the soul is within them. And so we should have them as part of the family. So, of course, in the Vedic civilization, the animals were part of the family as well. And even I know from the north of Scotland again that they used to have these like called black houses. So half the house was for the family and half the house was for the cows. So the cows would live in one half, the family in the other. And the heat from the cows would keep the family warm in the winter. And you'd also have that connection, that closeness. So that humanity comes from tending the animals, looking after them. And then against the principle of cleanliness is sexual activity, frivolous sexual activity. So this is really distracting most of society big time, of course, and it's the most captivating human preoccupation. And, of course, this descends into really terrible aspects in the age we're living in, such as prostitution, where young boys and girls are taken by the sex trade and forced into sexual relations with others. Very heavy stuff. And the world is just becoming aware of how rife this problem is. It's much bigger than anybody thought. It's a huge industry. And of course, people are becoming just hurt and wounded at a very young age. It's a terrible thing. And now we can see the effects even in India of sexual promiscuity. Like, I saw one thing about now that a lot of the girls in India, they just want to, of course, girls want to have fun, they want to dress up like the Western girls, but the boys, they don't know how to cope with that, so the boys are going a bit mad. And now you find that some of these girls have been attacked and raped and beaten up because to the men it seems like they're just like whores, so that they don't, there's a misunderstanding completely. But it doesn't help that a lot of the boys, like particularly in the villages, this is because the village mentality, can you imagine in such a short space of time, everything is changing so fast. But it doesn't help that the boys are now drinking all the time alcohol, which they can't at all cope with. So you take that combination of alcohol and sex, and it's just a big disaster. Of course, the Western world has been doing this, dealing with this for a long, long period of time. So in the Western world, it's become very refined, the whole thing. But it's, of course, chaotic. But now we're seeing this in India as well, which is a huge disaster. So we need all the help, as many people can come up, can become devotees in the world. That's really needed. It's very much required. But even though Kali was given those places to exist, Kali was banished from the world, but he's allowed to exist where there's intoxication, gambling, illicit sex life, and the killing of animals. But one place Kali was not allowed to exist is that place where devotees are performing sacrifices according to religious principles for the satisfaction of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That place, Kali, is not allowed to exist. So this is all about religious principles. So, yeah, so again, in Satya Yuga, all we had to do was just meditate. And the pure age, just meditate upon Krishna in the heart. But in Tretya Yuga, performing costly yagya sacrifices. And in Dvarpa Yuga, lavish deity worship. But in Kali Yuga, simply by performing the Sankirtan yagya, we can get all the benefits. We can drive the personality of Kali far away and save human society from falling prey to all these weaknesses, because Shri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has descended in this age with the holy name to give that benediction to us. And because he's descended, he's taking over the reins from Kali. So Kali will continue to exist throughout the Kali Yuga, but for these 10,000 years, Mahaprabhu is taking the position So now the possibility exists for all souls in the world to approach the Holy Name in that way because it's so accessible. So it says that Yagyai Sankirtan Prayer Yajanti Hi Sumedasa. So in the age of Kali, all the intelligent persons will perform congregational chanting of the Supreme Lord, especially this incarnation of Godhead who sings about Krishna so wonderfully. So we're honoring the Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and the Panchatattva who've come for this purpose. And so now the Supreme Lord is incarnated in this world in the form of the Holy Name, the transcendental sound vibration. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So easily accessible. Of course, it is a difficult age. It's very difficult on our minds. But the beauty is that it's freely available. So we should take our place in trying to spread this to all the fallen souls. Time has run out, as usual. Well, it's getting run out because there was a whole other aspect about this, is that about this time, place, and circumstance. Just to briefly say, because Maharaj Dushmanta, when he's saying that he knows all the laws of marriage, then in the Sanskrit, you hear that this is Desha Kala Vadana. So Desha, the place, Kala, the time, and often you hear this Desha Kala Patra, so time, place, and circumstance. So all the things in Vedic times were decided upon related to Desha Kala Patra, time, place, and circumstance. So that means even the Acharyas, they were able to work in terms of time, place, and circumstance as well. So we know that Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, he changed many aspects due to the nature of the age. And Srila Prabhupada, he made things possible to exist in this age. So when he had his disciples in America and Europe, he was being criticized in India, because in India they were saying, yeah, but what's going on here? There's free mixing of boys and girls. But they didn't understand that actually what Prabhupada was doing was, Prabhupada was going by the principle of religion was that the Holy Name has to be spread and it has to be preached in the world. So someone has to do it. So these American boys and girls, they were going to have to start doing this. But you couldn't change that culture of free intermingling and equality of men and women. You couldn't change that. So Prabhupada had to work on the principle, and just he did an expert job. So the men and the women were separated. So you had in the ashram, the men and the women were in separate ashrams. The grihasthas were not allowed to live in the temple. They had to live outside, and they had to follow the principles of religion and do the Garbhadhan samskara to bring saintly children into the world. But there was no free mixing of the men and the women. So I know in my life there was free mixing of men and women. Like my first romantic engagement about the age of 8, you know, it's ridiculous. And I just thought it was such an intense thing, and then that just repeated and repeated for over the years until I finally kind of figured it out, hopefully. But but we hear in the Vedic age quite differently. Like you had Brahmin boys from the age of 5 and some of the other castes maybe later, 6-7 years old, going to the Gurukul with the guru, and they'd learn already at that age. They'd be taken separate from the mother, separate from the girls of their own age, so that they could go through that process of purifying the mind and learn to understand. If you're so distracted by the women, you can't do anything. So that, I suppose, that's the austerity of the Grihastha ashram, that you have to, if there is any austerity in the Grihastha ashram, that's it, that you must live together with these principles of religion in place. But the other ashrams, they should be, well, of course, the Brahmacharya ashram and Sannyas ashram, of course, you're talking about that austerity is there, of that separation. But the one thing that His Holiness Kadambakanda Maharaj made this amazing point last week or the week before, that what's really missing in our movement is the Vanaprastha ashram, because even though you might go through the Brahmacharya ashram, you might decide, like many do, to go into the Grihastha ashram, but then what are you going to do? Are you going to spend your whole life in the Grihastha ashram where there's not so much austerity? What's missing is the next stage of vanaprastha. So after, by the age of 50, the children have grown up, you should renounce. Renouncing is supposed to be there. If there's no renouncing, then there's no real austerity. So can the movement really move into the next hundreds and thousands of years if that austerity must be there as a principle? So renunciation has to be there. I know it's probably very difficult to do, and you know, hats off to all the grihasthas who go for vanaprastha ashram. But I think it's you can see it through the eyes of these religious principles. It's a very important aspect. So we're kind of running out of time. There's a lot more I was going to say, but anyway, that's probably enough for me for the time being. But there's maybe one principle, and that is this. We should always remember Vishnu, Lord Vishnu, always remember him and never forget him at any time. So on all our actions, everything we do, we should always remember the Supreme Lord, and that is really the ultimate religious principle. So I don't know, would someone like to maybe add something or ask a question?